Hello and welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast. On this week's episode, we'll be discussing the rise of Marine Le Pen, how murder is handled on social media, and how a cake has changed the debate about gay rights. First up, Marine Le Pen's Front National has surged in the polls, and it now looks likely that she will make the presidential runoff in next year's election. In this week's cover feature, Jonathan Femby looks at how Le Pen has changed the French right and considers the prospects of her rivals François Hollande and Nicolas Sarkozy. I'm joined now from Paris by Agnès Poirier and Spectator writer Gavin Mortimer to discuss these changes to the French political landscape. So Agnès, do you think Marine Le Pen could actually win the election next year?
No, she can't win. But what she can do very well is to go through to the second round of the presidential elections, just like her father did 15 years ago.
I agree with Agnès that she won't win, but she will go through to the second round. In fact, there was a poll in yesterday's Figaro which said, who will people vote for in the first round? And Le Pen and Juppé were tied at 28%. Hollande had 9%. So that shows you, really, I think that's a clear indication of the people, the two candidates in the second round. Marine Le Pen really has played a very... She's cleaned up the image of the Front National since her father. And, of course, the two have had a very bitter falling out. And she's taken away from his denial of a Holocaust, where you call it just a detail, and the overt racism that it was associated with. And she's tried to clean it up. And she's doing quite a good job. And, of course, she's helped by the fact that the French economy is in such a poor state, that with the depressed areas, particularly in the north and in the south, allied, of course, to the Islamic attacks since that had been going on since March 2012. And so people are turning to her because they're just fed up with the traditional political parties.
And Agnès, what exactly is it that Marine Le Pen is offering voters that's different to the other politicians on offer?
Well, I mean, as Kevin said, you know, her great success is that she's not her father. He's a woman who is born in 68. She's twice divorced. She's single mother. She's pro-gay rights. She's distanced herself from the ultra-Catholics, whom actually she doesn't like at all. She cuts a completely different figure from her father. She's also not interested in the Second World War and collaborationists. And she doesn't have any friends who were part. I mean, most of them are dead, but her father had friends who dodgy people who worked for the Vichy government against De Gaulle. And also, she's not interested at all in the Franco-Algerian War. So she doesn't come with much baggage, apart from, obviously, the family history. And as Kevin said, she has been absolutely so astute in distancing herself and also in ejecting from the party anyone who said something remotely anti-Semitic or xenophobic. I met her for a two-hour tête-à-tête. She's extremely impressive. She didn't say one thing that, you know, you could have thought was provocative. No, everything she says is quite acceptable, quite reasonable. That's what she sounds like, of course. You can question her deep convictions and her sincerity, but that's the key to her success. Also, she has managed to occupy the ground that the left should be occupying. That is to say, the defense of secularism, for instance. And it is such a terrible, tragic irony that she should be the defender of secularism coming from the sort of ultra-Catholic extreme right. And so far for her, it's, you know, she's been absolutely impeccable, hence her success, because people tend to believe what they are told.
And Gavin, do you think that, in the light of all of this, do you think Hollande still has a chance, and or not necessarily Hollande, but a left-wing party still has a chance of making it next year?
No, not really. Hollande, certainly not. Le Monde yesterday gave his latest approval rating is 4%. The rest of the left, they're too divided. You've got Jean-Luc Mélenchon, the far left, he'll be standing. You've got, obviously, Manuel Valls, the prime minister. And you've got Emmanuel Macron, who's the young late 30s, who's been called, actually, the spiritual son of Thatcher recently. And he's someone who was brought in by Hollande as a economic advisor about 3 years ago, and and then left earlier this year when he fell out with Hollande. So they're very divided, the left, and I can't see any way that they're going to go through to the second round.
And Agnes, in Jonathan Wemby's piece, he suggests that Sarkozy's actually moved further to the right to sort of counter Marine Le Pen. Do you think he's actually becoming more extreme in some of the policies he's offering than Marine?
Well, not more extreme than 5 years ago when he attempted to occupy, you know, the fringe between the extreme right and the hard right, and he failed and was not elected. So we'll see. I mean, we should talk about the primaries, because it's the first time that the right-wing party, the main right-wing party in France, is actually doing primaries. And if it is open to all French citizens, and if a lot of people who are not members of Sarkozy's party go and cast their votes in November, the 20th and the 27th, there's a real chance that Sarkozy is not going to make it through just to run for the elections. And the same for Hollande and the Socialist Party, which is going to run also their own primaries. So I think actually the key thing of those next elections are going to happen in the next few weeks, because if we have Sarkozy and Hollande at the first round, Marine Le Pen goes through the second round, you know, very, very easily. Now, if it's Alain Juppé versus, let's say, Manuel Valls, the current prime minister, that's a completely different story.
In his piece, he also suggests that while she's also picking up working class votes, she's picking up more middle class votes too. Have both of you found that it's become more socially acceptable to say that you're voting for Front National?
My experience talking to people I know in Paris, I think it has become more socially acceptable, or certainly more, it's a possibility now, but I still think there's a slight shame, if you like, in saying you vote for a Front National among the middle class. But the fact that they got 6.8 million votes in the regional elections in December suggests that certainly some people, middle class people, are voting for Le Pen. What Le Pen hasn't managed to do so far really is to attract the over 60 votes. They're fearful of her wish to leave the euro and the upheaval that would entail. And their lives are obviously, I'm generalising here, but are more stable than the young. And it's the young who are voting for her, and also some middle class. And I think the security is driving more people towards Le Pen among the middle class and the recent attacks. And something that I've been interested to see that hasn't really received much coverage in the UK, but for the last nearly 10 days now, each night there have been police demonstrations. The police have been not on strike, but they've been gathering in cities across France to demonstrate, because they're just fed up. They're fed up with what they see are weak courts and punishments, and just that they're being overworked, or they're being attacked by far-left protesters during the recent employment law marches, and of course the ongoing fight against Islamic terrorism. So security is a key issue, and that plays very much to the strengths of Marine Le Pen.
And Agnes, also in Femby's piece, he suggests that France has somewhat lost its way, and that Marine Le Pen is tapping into a kind of similar sentiment to what Donald Trump is doing in America. Do you think that's a fair comparison?
Well, it's a valid comparison, but then, you know, we can talk about Brexit. You know, the night of Brexit, I thought, okay, well, everything's possible, because Brexit is a sort of Trumpism and is a sort of Le Penism. So every country has their own streak of populism.
And so this is all just a rise against the kind of elite, and what's happening in the UK is similar to France?
Yes, a rise against elite, if you'd like, in the sense that Paris doesn't vote for Marine Le Pen in the same way that London doesn't vote for Brexit. But it's also a game to say that there's a system, that there's, therefore you have to vote against the system, that the elite is corrupted. You know, the elite is the representation, the embodiment of a country. So I think we should, if we are against that so-called system, we should all look at ourselves in the mirror in the morning, because we are all a figment of that system.
That was Agnes Poirier and Gavin Mortimer. 6 months ago, Andrew Watt's university friend was murdered at his home in Oxford. Both his friend's death and the recent conviction of his killer were revealed to Andrew via social media, as strangers joked about the tragedy. In this week's magazine, Andrew writes about his anger at the response and how the benevolence extended to figures on the left, such as Joe Cox, hasn't been extended to a man who was murdered for being a Tory. Andrew joins me now to discuss. You've written a piece about your friend who was murdered 6 months ago. Can you tell us a bit about what happened?
Well, I don't want to go into the details of the murder too much at all, or to talk about him, because he was an old friend, someone I knew from university. We had lost touch a bit, but we still met up regularly. And he was killed, and I think the thing that really shocked me and what was the cause of the article was that I found all the details from someone posting a joke about it on Twitter. Actually, one was on Facebook, but all part of the same thing.
Social media, yeah.
Yeah, and...
And was there someone that you knew who knew him as well?
Oh, no, it was a friend from a completely different circle. But it just struck me that... I have friends from two completely different circles because I went to a very traditional university. Now I work in the arts. And so I get Facebook messages, Facebook posts and things from two completely different worlds, really, who don't seem to have any interaction with each other at all. And that is really what the article is about, that I feel that this is harmful, particularly because, in this case, one of the details that came out was that the murderer had a particular prejudice against Tories, or scum Tories, as he talked about. And that didn't seem to be... something that people were talking about, whereas in relation to Joe Cox's murder, that comes up all the time from my liberal friends. Whenever there is an attack on polls or, you know, these are serious incidents, but they will say, well, this is the fault of the Brexiteers.
And do you think there's a link between the sort of rhetoric you're seeing on social media and the murder itself and Joe Cox's murder?
I think there's a parallel between the two. I think that... I don't think it's cause and effect, that if you say that you want to leave Europe, people are going to start killing each other. I don't think that's true. And I don't think it's true that people quoting Aneurin Bevin, that led directly to the death of a friend. But I think those two are analogous, and I don't understand why... one isn't taken as seriously as the other.
And in your piece you talk about punching up and how it sort of seemed to be acceptable to punch up but not down, and you think that that's linked into this. Can you explain that aspect of this?
Well, it was more that a lot of people, again, from the left-wing world, think that it's fine to insult other people because they're in a position of power. And to an extent that's true, and particularly a lot of my friends are comedians, and that's basically a rule of comedy. It's polite, and you know, you get a better laugh if you're insulting the Prime Minister than you do if you're insulting someone on the street. But I think that seems to have been raised into a political philosophy almost.
And you also talk about purifying, people talking about kind of purifying their social media, which sounds slightly kind of creepy aspect to it. Do you think that's kind of part of this, that people are purifying their social media and not necessarily realising how that actually looks in a kind of broader sense?
Yeah, well, I think it's bad for you that you don't know what other people are thinking. What was quite interesting is that when I wrote this, I wrote about the sort of left liberal consensus, and I described them as canary sharers. I don't know if you know the Canary left wing.
The online publication, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It works by... the writers are paid by... click, and so they have the most outrageous headlines, and I tend to hate click them. And it was taken out by the editor because no one in the office knew what the canary was.
There was actually an interesting piece, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal, looking at people's social media, or looking at their Facebook feeds, depending on what they liked. So if you liked a lot of kind of pro-Democrat stuff, you basically your feed turned blue and everything you saw was blue. If you liked a lot of Republican stuff, the same thing happened, but red. Do you think that's kind of what's happening in the UK as well? People are just starting to become very kind of...
Absolutely, yeah. It's terrifying.
That was Andrew Watts. And finally, Asher's Bakery in Belfast could hardly have been expected to find themselves at the centre of a 2016 political storm. But this week, they lost their appeal over a landmark discrimination case. Bakers had refused to produce a cake with the slogan, "Support Gay Marriage," and consequently fell foul of the Equal Rights Lobby. Here to discuss the controversial verdict and the nuanced politics of cake baking are Melanie McDonough and Peter Tatchell. So, Melanie, you say that there's a troubling logic at the heart of this cake case. Why is that?
Well, the problem isn't with the provision of cake. I don't think anybody was suggesting that Ashers shouldn't have provided cake to Gareth Lee. They'd served before. They have every intention of serving him again. They have no problem with his being homosexual, and the provision of cake is for all comers. The only problem they've got is with the slogan that they're required to ice on the cake, and there they're entering into rather different territory. The icy on the cake, as it were, the problem, and the icy on the cake says support gay marriage, which they don't. And so you can say that the service that they're offering, the provision of cake, is certainly for every member of the community, Catholic, Protestant, male, female, heterosexual, homosexual. And in that sense, they're providing it impartially. But where it requires them actually to engage in what you might call a propaganda exercise, then they draw the line.
And Peter, you've changed your views on this. So can you outline what your original view was and how it's changed?
Well, initially, I supported the legal action against Ashers, largely for two reasons. Firstly, because Ashers had falsely advertised their service. They said on their website that they were happy to make a cake with a decoration of the customer's choosing. They didn't say there were any limits or any restrictions on the wording of the cake or the ornament on the cake. So when Gareth Lee followed through with good intention based on that promise, Ashers turned around and refused to put that slogan, support gay marriage, on the cake. So that was a breach of contract because they had offered to make a cake with a slogan of the customer's choosing, or with a wording of the customer's choosing. The other reason why I initially supported it was because I was concerned that if Ashers were able to refuse, this could set in motion a precedent which could be exploited by Republicans and Loyalists to deny members of other their respective opposite communities services. What prompted my change in the end was that I thought, on balance, as Melanie has said quite clearly, Ashers were not discriminating against Gareth Lee because he was gay. It was simply because of the message he wanted on the cake, which they disagreed with. And although I think it is a complex, grey, ambiguous issue, I think on balance, I decided to err on the side of freedom of expression, conscience and religion.
But when you say that they entered into a contract to provide a cake and to decorate a cake with a message of the customer's choosing, I don't think we need to spell out in the small print that this has to be brackets as the law of God allows, or brackets insofar as it's congruent with conscience. I mean, there's a very swanky little confectionery outlet in Borough Market which sells little fondant fancies at Halloween saying, fuck me. And I think that we can assume that if Ashers had been required to write this little legend on its fondant fancies, it would have drawn the line there as well. In fact, we know that they say that they would draw the line at obscene remarks or disobliging remarks about gay people, spiteful remarks. I don't think you need to spell out in your provision of goods and services for icing cakes that, in fact, your confectionery has to be congruent with conscience.
Well, I would disagree there. I think certainly they would have an argument to deny a wording that was unlawful, such as inciting violence. But I don't think that conscience was written into their contract, or is a generally assumed provision of a contract. A contract is a contract. If they say they're willing to make a cake with a decoration of the customer's choosing, that is pretty clear.
Well, I think that their assumption, and I think a reasonable assumption, was that when they said it would be a message of the customer's choosing, it would be sort of happy birthday, Gareth, rather than support gay marriage or...
The law doesn't operate on assumptions.
It is a reasonable assumption that you won't actually be required actually to engage in, for instance, obscene comments for a Valentine's cake.
Well, obscenity is another issue because that's technically against the law.
Well, asking somebody to write shag me on a cake wouldn't be against the law. It would simply be against their conscience because it would be encouraging others to engage in activity that they would themselves draw the line at and wouldn't want to promulgate.
Peter, would it have been different if it was a homophobic message on the cake?
Well, that's precisely why I've now, or one of the reasons why I've come to oppose the action against Ashers, because the appeal court ruling basically said that a cake maker or any other business essentially has to provide or facilitate a message whether they agree with it or not. So this would imply that a gay baker could be forced under threat of legal sanctions to put an anti-gay message on a cake, oppose gay marriage, stop equal rights for gay people. And I don't think that a gay baker should be forced to do that. Equally, I don't think that potentially a Muslim printer should be obliged to publish the cartoons of Muhammad, or a Jewish printer to publish a book that endorses Holocaust denial. So I think that those are the reasons and concerns that have motivated my change of position.
I think actually you're okay on the homophobic remarks and icing. The protected groups under the law are in terms of politics and religion, designed, as you said in your original statement, to protect Catholics and loyalists against problematic withdrawal of services on the basis of religion and nationalism. So homosexuals are a protected group under the law. So I think the notion that you could be obliged to write homophobic comments doesn't actually enter into the equation.
I don't think simply saying oppose gay marriage is, well, I suppose it is homophobic.
It's not homophobic. I'm not a homophobe, but against gay marriage, simply because of my own understanding of marriage.
Yeah.
But I'm just not homophobic. And from what I can gather, neither would they describe themselves as being. But I think that it's like if you have a PR company and somebody comes along and say, will you sort of campaign for liberalisation of the abortion laws? I would tell them where to shove their commission. But presumably on the basis that you're a PR company, you're allowed to offer goods and services to all comers. But if it violates your own conscience, I think that you should be within your rights in saying, no, I won't.
You've raised the issue of protected characteristics.
That's in the law,
That's in the law, and that was cited in the appeal court judgment.
It was, yeah.
Against ASHES. I have anxieties about that
because
there are many people who fall outside, you know, the six or seven protected characteristics, but I think also are entitled to equal protection.
Well, yeah. I mean, and atheists are entitled to equal protection as well as people of...
Atheists are covered in religion or belief.
Oh, I see, yes.
But, for example, ex-prisoners, travellers, refugees, immigrants are not...
They're not
recognised
as
protected characteristics.
Yes.
So I think citing protected characteristics as a basis for this judgment is selective and dangerous.
The other aspect in which it's selective, dangerous and just silly, and I do think that the Lord Chief Justice, Declan Moran, is a complete idiot, and I'm quite prepared to ice that on my own cake, is where he says that this is analogous to being required to write sort of Happy Halloween and put little witches on your cake, or to ice an Everton cake if you happen to be a Manchester United supporter. The whole idea that you're equating something essentially a frivolous matter of taste, however seriously you may take football, with something that profoundly relates to your moral convictions, I think is to diminish the whole question. And I don't think he should have been allowed to get away with that.
No, I absolutely agree. I think that was a frivolous, trivial example, not a fair comparison.
Yeah.
And I think it shows just how desperate they were scratching around to try and find a reason to uphold the original judgment against ASHES. I do think that the appeal court judges acted with good intentions. I think their intention was to protect and support the LGBT community, which particularly in Northern Ireland, has been historically subject to incredible victimisation.
Yes, indeed.
And, you know, many years ago, many, many years ago, of course, LGBT organisations were often refused services by mainstream, you know, printers or whatever, because of opposition to gay equality.
Well, presumably that would be on the basis of orientation rather than...
But now the situation has changed. And to me, the clear distinction is that discrimination against people is always wrong.
Yes.
But discrimination against ideas is part and parcel of a free and open society. We shouldn't be compelling people to support and endorse and facilitate ideas with which they have a fundamental disagreement.
That was Melanie McDonough and Peter Tatchell. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. And if you enjoy the podcast, why not try out the magazine? You can read all the features discussed in the podcast, as well as great pieces by Douglas Murray, Danny Kruger and Emily Hill. And we've got a trial offer. Get 12 issues, which is £12, by visiting spectator.co.uk/12. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.